I talk about the American war machine. The focus may be in Washington, but it isn't just Washington. President Eisenhower alerted us to the dangers of a military-industrial complex, and that is what we are dealing with now. When, you know, he made that warning in 1961, and it was still, I would have said, a minority sector of the American economy and American industrial system and so on. It has grown and grown. There was a chance for it to shrink after we pulled out of Vietnam. And in both my books, Road to 9/11 and this one, I look at the 70s. It was a choice of go back to being a trading nation and cut back on the military. And some people wanted to do that, but some other people said, no, 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 we're pulling out of Vietnam, but that means we have to increase our war, our defense budget. And the second group were certainly a minority when it comes to public opinion, but they were very well financed by the military-industrial complex, and they are the group that succeeded, so that we now essentially have a military economy in this country. We are not the kind of producers of all kinds of goods that we used to be. Automobiles, forget it. You would say there's some areas where we're still cutting edge, like aircraft were pretty good, electronics were extremely good, computers, all that sort of thing. Those are war-related industries and is the key to our dominance in civilian electronics like iPhones and so on. The bottom of that is the miniaturization of electronics, which was subsidized by the U.S. government as part of its military and space development plans. So we are a war economy. And the newspapers, which was your question, part of Eisenhower didn't mention newspapers. And I have to say, in the this is a big difference between the Vietnam War and the Afghan War and Iraq War, that the newspapers provided about the only, and television, the media provided the only large-scale criticism of the war that we had back then. There were also individual observers on the ground, but the newspapers did a relatively good job of reporting about how the war wasn't working the way that General Westmoreland was reporting that it was working. And that and the draft helped fuel the anti-war movement that was a factor in bringing the war to the end. Now, newspapers are more dependent than ever on the government for their information. And particularly in Iraq, all the reporters were embedded in the troops. They were really subject to military discipline. They went where the army said they could go, and they didn't go where the army said they couldn't go. And this is another factor in this has been, as my friend Ben Bagdikian has written about, my friend and neighbor, that there's been corporate consolidation of the media. And specifically, the the gap between the military industrial complex and the media complex has narrowed. And you had big corporate firms that were in the war business bought the media. And when particularly ABC at a certain point was being more critical than the other networks of what was going on in government. And this was at a time when William Casey was the head of the CIA, and a corporation that William Casey had a personal connection to bought ABC. And in ways like this, and that's not the only factor, I mean, corporate concentration is one. Another is that the major source of significant news being the government, the so-called responsible media have to maintain good relations with the government or they won't get the information. And that was one of the issues with the Pentagon Papers, that when the Washington Post and the New York Times defied Nixon and published the papers he didn't want published, the response of Mitchell, who was Nixon's attorney general, was, we're going to punish the Washington Post, take away its TV license. And in the end, there was then a battle royal, and in the end, Washington Post, New York Times won, and Nixon resigned. But if Nixon hadn't resigned, I think the Washington Post would have lost its television license. And that is an object lesson which all the media remember, that they are dependent, particularly in television, which is a matter of licenses, dependent on government favors. So we are facing a war machine that reaches into the economy, reaches into the media, and this is an aspect I didn't write so much, but reaches into the academy, that political science professors get their promotions by books that are subsidized by the CIA, by their access to sitting on committees in Washington that gives them status. That casts a shadow over the whole political science field of the academy. And that's why I actually, my PhD was in political science, but I chose to follow a different career and taught in English, where I didn't have to deal with that, well, not deal as much with that kind of shadow cast over the academy.
Professor Scott, in your book, you make a reference to the financial military industrial complex. Would you like to elucidate on that a little bit?
Yes. I think that, by the way, President Eisenhower's speech about the military-industrial complex was very important and very accurate at that time.
And that's a perfect cue for listening to Eisenhower's valedictory address. This is from 50 years ago last Monday. This is the speech which coined the phrase military-industrial complex, and even half a century ago he was going to say military-industrial-congressional complex, but was advised that this would be untactful, and he decided not to tread on those toes. Compare and contrast the beauty, the depth, and the personal input in some areas of this speech with the mass-produced product that is current American political rhetoric to really understand about what dumbing down has meant in practice. When did we last hear an American president calling for an educated populace to discern the influence of money, the need to keep federal power in check, to remain vigilant about the control of the arms industry? If you'd like to hear the whole of it, that's available for download from our website.
We annually spend on military security alone more than the net income of all United States corporations. Now, this conjunction of an immense military establishment and a large arms industry is new in the American experience. The total influence, economic, political, even spiritual, is felt in every city, every state house, every office of the federal government. We recognize the imperative need for this development, yet we must not fail to comprehend its grave implications. Our toil, resources, and livelihood are all involved. So is the very structure of our society. In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic processes. We should take nothing for granted. Only an alert and knowledgeable citizenry can compel the proper meshing of the huge industrial and military machinery of defense with our peaceful methods and goals, so that security and liberty may prosper together. Akin to and largely responsible for the sweeping changes in our industrial military posture has been the technological revolution during recent decades. In this revolution, research has become central. It also becomes more formalized, complex, and costly. A steadily increasing share is conducted for, by, or at the direction of the federal government. Today, the solitary inventor, tinkering in his shop, has been overshadowed by task forces of scientists in laboratories and testing fields. In the same fashion, the free university, historically the fountainhead of free ideas and scientific discovery, has experienced a revolution in the conduct of research, partly because of the huge costs involved. A government contract becomes virtually a substitute for intellectual curiosity. For every old blackboard, there are now hundreds of new electronic computers. The prospect of domination of the nation's scholars by federal employment, project allocations, and the power of money is ever present and is gravely to be regarded. Yet in holding scientific research and discovery in respect, as we should, we must also be alert to the equal and opposite danger that public policy could itself become the captive of a scientific, technological elite. It is the task of statesmanship to mold, to balance, and to integrate these and other forces, new and old, within the principles of our democratic system, ever aiming toward the supreme goals of our free society. Another factor in maintaining balance involves the element of time. As we peer into society's future, we, you and I, and our government must avoid the impulse to live only for today, plundering for our own ease and convenience the precious resources of tomorrow. We cannot mortgage the material assets of our grandchildren without risking the loss also of their political and spiritual heritage. We want democracy to survive for all generations to come, not to become the insolvent phantom of tomorrow. During the long lane of the history yet to be written, America knows that this world of ours, ever growing smaller, must avoid becoming a community of dreadful fear and hate, and be instead a proud confederation of mutual trust and respect. Such a confederation must be one of equals. The weakest must come to the conference table with the same confidence as do we, protected as we are by our moral, economic, and military strength. That table, though scarred by many past frustrations, cannot be abandoned for the certainty agony of the battlefield. Disarmament with mutual honor and confidence is a continuing imperative. Together we must learn how to compose differences, not with arms, but with intellect and decent purpose. Because this need is so sharp and apparent, I confess that I lay down my official responsibilities in this field with a definite sense of disappointment. As one who has witnessed the horror and the lingering sadness of war, as one who knows that another war could utterly destroy this civilization, which has been so slowly and painfully built over thousands of years, I wish I could say tonight that a lasting peace is in sight. Happily, I can say that war has been avoided. Steady progress toward our ultimate goal has been made, but so much remains to be done. As a private citizen, I shall never cease to do what little I can to help the world advance along that road. So in this, my last good night to you as your president, I thank you for the many opportunities you have given me for public service in war and in peace. I trust in that service, you find some things worthy. As for the rest of it, I know you will find ways to improve performance in the future. You and I, my fellow citizens, need to be strong in our faith that all nations under God will reach the goal of peace with justice. May we be ever unswerving in devotion to principle, confident but humble with power, diligent in pursuit of the nation's great goals. To all the peoples of the world, I once more give expression to America's prayerful and continuing aspiration. We pray that peoples of all faiths all races, all nations, may have their great human needs satisfied, that those now denied opportunity shall come to enjoy it to the full, that all who yearn for freedom may experience its spiritual blessings. Those who have freedom will understand also its heavy responsibility, that all who are insensitive to the needs of others will learn charity, and that the sources, scourges of poverty, disease, and ignorance will be made disappear from the earth, and that in the goodness of time, all peoples will come to live together in a peace guaranteed by the binding force of mutual respect and love. Now, on Friday noon, I am to become a private citizen. I am proud to do so. I look forward to it. Thank you, and good night.
Now, of course, I appreciate Eisenhower's warning that, quote, the power of money is ever present and is gravely to be regarded, unquote. I wonder, has any American president ever pointed at the power of money since Kennedy was assassinated? Eisenhower was talking about domination of the nation's scholars. Of course, that's certainly true today, but it seems to me in the last half century more and more aspects of life are being dominated by the power of money. And I recommend Peter Dale Scott as an antidote to gradualism, listening to his revelations about the global drugs trade and the financial military industrial complex. I find quite a persuasive antidote against the idea that if we just introduce a few more laws or remove a few more laws, that we can change the money system into something that is serving humanity and not dominating ever more aspects of life. I find myself convinced by Charles Eisenstein's perspective that the history of money has been a history of consuming natural, social, and every other kind of resource, bringing what was commonly held, commonly shared, and enjoyed into a framework of domination so that it's privately held, squandered, and abused. Of course, the power of money derives only from its hold on the psyche, from people's belief, for example, that money is necessary to survive, something that, on sober reflection, is an obvious fiction. How long is it until we're going to get that kind of sober reflection from the majority of the populace? Let's hope, for the sake of the planet's ecological base, that it's coming sooner rather than later. Now let's get back to the remainder of the Peter Dale Scott interview.
It's interesting that he had to do it more or less in secret. Most of his staff were unaware he was going to do this. But it's grown since his time. And so it's true. I will now talk, actually at one point I think I said the financial petroleum military industrial complex. New York, Wall Street has always been behind the CIA and so on. But Wall Street investments in the military-industrial complex have become more and more important to firms like Lehman Brothers. It's defunct now, but it became giant because of its investment in the military-industrial complex, and other firms still surviving, Goldman Sachs, all did the same things. And I actually, in the Road to 9/11, trace the career of one man. He begins as a military officer, and then he's an officer in one of the defense industries, and then he ends up in New York with one of the big financial firms. So there is that unity linking the financial world to the others. Also, petroleum is huge. I mean, some of our biggest multinational corporations are Exxon, Chevron, and they work with the CIA closely, and they are major, one of the major consumers of petroleum is the U.S. Armed Forces. A great deal of oil goes to, used to be the Navy, but now I imagine the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq are major things. So, and all the stuff that's going on in Central Asia whether it's Iraq or Afghanistan, it's clear that America sees that the world's oil reserves are running out, that most of the unproven reserves are, Iraq itself, but also places like Kazakhstan and Turkmenistan, oil and gas, maybe not quite as much as they thought at one time there would be. But the covert politics, the reason why Casey, for example, used Arab Afghans to cross into Russia, into the Soviet Union, and stir up trouble there, is they were playing a kind of covert politics which led to the breakup of the Soviet Union, which led to Chevron and Exxon being major investors now in Kazakhstan, and they want to have U.S. troops somewhere near so that the heads of these countries will think of themselves as friends of America and not as they would otherwise, friends of Russia. And there's quite a lot being played out there under the surface that involves the petroleum companies along with the CIA and the U.S. armed forces. And cannot the petroleum side of things, it's complicated. I can't give it to you in a sentence, but it certainly underlies why we have fought wars in both Afghanistan and in Iraq. So it is a complex, it's not the same thing. Some people would just say America is a fascist dictatorship, and I never say that. I don't believe it. I do believe that America is a constitutional democracy whose processes have been threatened and in part superseded by this American war machine, which takes advantage of the openness of American politics, and as the decades go by, has more and more money to dominate the political process, so that it's becoming harder and harder to use democracy to defeat this war machine. But it's important to keep in mind that the war machine is not America, and that is vividly illustrated, for example, in 1963, when you have a president who is determined to start taking troops out of Vietnam, and the war machine is already equally determined to escalate the war in Vietnam, and the result is a head-on collision, and the president is assassinated in a deep event which to this day remains unsolved.
Professor Scott, do we have a precedent with COINTELPRO with what's going on today?
COINTELPRO was a series of programs. They were actually FBI programs, short for counterintelligence. What it was in practice was infiltration of the anti-war. The big ones were against the Martin Luther King, against the Black Panthers. I was at a little Bay Area institute. All we did was publish stuff about the war, and there were only about 12 of us. I believe there was a COINTELPRO directed against us, and I remember I gave a talk by invitation only to about 10 people. It was all arranged over the phone, and an 11th person turned up. None of us knew him. And he said, "Oh, I heard about it on KPFA." Well, he certainly didn't. He was penetrating our little thing. That was a major aspect of America in the time of the Vietnam War, and also of the it affected very much the various African American movements like the Black Panthers. Could be quite bloody there. People were set up to be killed and some of them murdered. The head of the Black Panthers in Chicago was flat out murdered by the Chicago police. He was asleep in bed and they came in and riddled him with machine gun bullets. The CIA was also at that time quite illegally, it was not in their charter, but they were They had Operation Chaos, which was also surveillance on, and I think more than surveillance on, I've seen the Operation Chaos documents on one man whose offense was that he turned up at a protest with a placard, and the CIA did an investigation on him to find out who he was. So, we, of course, it doesn't have to be called COINTELPRO now, because thanks to 9/11, we had the institution of, right that very morning, before the last plane went down, the institution of what are called continuity of government procedures. And this is something I've been talking a lot about recently, and I talk about in American War Machine, secret plans that Cheney and Rumsfeld, among others, had been working on for 20 years. Originally plans for a response to a nuclear attack, so they're very extreme plans, like suspending the Constitution, imposing military government. Two of them, very clear from what we know from the 1980s when they were working on it, warrantless surveillance and warrantless detention. And since 9/11, we've had both of those. People have no idea how the impact on the Muslims in this country, Arabs in this country, how many of them were surveilled in this way, and how many of them were detained without. Habeas corpus is something that goes back to Magna Carta and to the Bill of Rights in England in the 17th century. And it's mentioned in, what's mentioned in the Constitution are the conditions under which you can override it, but the assumption is you will have it. We don't have it because of continuity of government. And I must say, and there's a state of emergency that justifies the continuity of government proceedings. And when Obama was elected, a former congressman and I appealed to Obama and appealed to the Congress to do something about the state of emergency and to do something about these COG regulations. And there's actually a statute. One of the post-Watergate reforms was a statute that says if there's an emergency proclaimed, Congress must, not has the right to, but must, by law, review that state of emergency and either approve it or terminate it. Well, we've had a state of emergency now for 10 years or 9 years, and Congress hasn't done what by law it should do. And when I tried to mount nationwide protest on this, one of the congressmen replied to a constituent, and he said, well, that's because that statute has been overridden by continuity of government. Well, I've been saying all along that continuity of government has superseded the Constitution, and this, if true, would be an example of it. Another is that in 2007, George Bush extended the proclamation of emergency, he appended in an appendix certain continuity of government new procedures, and the Congressman Pete DeFazio from Oregon, under pressure again from the 9/11 truth movement, asked to see those measures. He was on the Homeland Security Committee, which would have been the relevant House committee. He was told he couldn't see them. So he got the chairman of his committee to sign a letter with him requesting to see them. And they were told they didn't have the clearance to see them. So here's a whole aspect of government which is, in effect, superseding the regular government, and Congress is told it doesn't have the right to look at it. I consider this extremely important, and again, it's unfortunate that so few Americans know about it, but I wish they would go and Google for those of you who have computers and web access, Google for continuity of government or proclamation of emergency and see this terrible situation we're in, where apparently Congress is told they don't have the power. Well, if we don't have checks and balances, we don't have the American Constitution as it was designed, and we should at least know that.
Professor Scott, what is the significance of the current role of surveillance and detention in the creation of what I would call the matrix mindset? I'm thinking of Brzezinski, FEMA connection, and what is the real grand chessboard?
Well, the last thing you asked was about Brzezinski's grand chessboard.
Okay.
And he has described geopolitics as a kind of game of chess in which the major powers of the world are struggling to win control of the geopolitical center of the world, which is Central Asia. And I have a chapter in my book about the real grand chessboard, which is talking about geopolitics, and I'm glad we brought this up. To some people, geopolitics is a science, and there have been some sensible papers written in it. But underlying it is the idea of total control of the world, which is the game that's being played. And this has reached into strategic planning in the Pentagon, and they actually have this strategic dominance document, which I quote from, which is saying that it is the objective of the United States to have the power to control any situation anywhere in the world. And I am asking us to step back for a moment and realize that this is insane. Just totally insane. If America can't control a country like Afghanistan or a country like Iraq, it surely should have learned in the last decade that it can't even control, enlarge a country, let alone control any situation in that country. And yet, that is what the strategic planning, thanks to geopolitical thinkers like Brzezinski, not just Brzezinski, Cheney is equally guilty, Rumsfeld probably equally guilty, but certainly Cheney, when he was Secretary of Defense under George Bush the First, tried to push this doctrine onto thing, and it is insane, and it's particularly ironic that the man who developed this, Mackinder, back in 1919, he developed this doctrine of geopolitics at a time when Britain had technically won the First World War, but in so doing had weakened itself to the extent that it was no longer going to play the role that was being depicted for it in theory by geopolitics. And geopolitics was then taken over by the Nazis, and that was the source of their Drang nach Osten, the idea that they would drive to the east and create a Reich that would last for 1,000 years. That was their doctrine, and the Reich didn't last 1,000 years. It lasted barely a decade. And now America, at the stage where it essentially has lost its cutting-edge dominance. It is still a dominant power, but it's not dominant the way it was in the 1950s, when it dominated militarily and also economically and also financially. Well, we still dominate militarily, but like Britain in 1919, we are no longer the financial and economic power. We have sacrificed our financial and economic power to preserve a military establishment that we don't need and is in the long run going to do us more harm than good, and certainly isn't protecting us from terrorism. I want to make that point. Some good progress has been made against Al-Qaeda in the last decade. It has all been police work. The military efforts have been a disaster. And we have just put now 100,000 new troops, and there's that many more mercenaries or contractors. And how many al-Qaeda in Afghanistan, according to Bob, according to the advisors to Obama, less than 60. They've all moved somewhere else. We put the military into Afghanistan, and they did the obvious thing and moved next door to Pakistan. So are we then going to invade Pakistan, which has nuclear weapons? I sincerely hope we don't, but I don't totally rule it out. I don't totally rule out action against Iran, which Israel desperately wants, and which may or may not happen. But my big point is that this doctrine of geopolitics is a kind of rationalization for military power that is part of the disease. It is corrupted thinking. It's very profitable thinking. In the chapter, when I talk about the real grand chessboard, I'm talking about all these private military corporations and private intelligence corporations who are in this for profit. And therefore, they should not be allowed to lay a finger on strategic planning, because they will obviously plan for what is profitable. And, you know, a lot of words were wasted trying to figure out why we made a mistake about the weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. Well, the simple answer is we made that mistake collectively as a nation because we relied on private intelligence from private intelligence contractors like SAIC in particular, who had a profit reason to say that they were there. And it's particularly a sign of how bad things have got in Washington that the question of finding out why we made that mistake was contracted out to a private contractor, which was SAIC. So SAIC was given the job of investigating itself, and no surprise, they failed to mention that SAIC had been a big part of the reason why we went in. Because our intelligence now is being handed out to private contractors. Surveillance is being handed out to private contractors. And this is a mask, by the way, for the militarization of police work in this country, which was done in 2002 as a result, I would say, of COG. When we created a military command for America, NORTHCOM. We have a SOUTHCOM for South America, CENTCOM for Central Asia. NORTHCOM for North America we're not fighting a war here yet, but on the intelligence level and surveillance level, they are involved at the grassroots level together with private contractors and with local police agencies. And this is a militarization of the way this country is run, that there were statutes that expressly forbade this, the so-called Posse Comitatus Acts, which limited any military involvement to extreme emergency. And that is a dead letter now, because they're involved with everything. And as I say, it's very disappointing that the Democrats coming in 2009, they had the presidents. They certainly controlled the House. They barely controlled the Senate from time to time. Did nothing about this. So we're going to have to turn the country around, but it's going to have to come from outside the existing political process. It's going to have to be done on the level of mobilizing civil society to change what's happening, and particularly to train Americans that against money, and there's so much money now coming in that American voters are going to have to just figure out which candidate's getting the most money and vote for the opposite one, because money is the source of the corruption.
Professor Scott, in your book, you talk quite a bit about Mexico. Could we touch on Mexico, the relevance of Mexico in all of this?
Yeah, well, I chose to begin my looking at the global drug connection abroad, because it is the country where, first of all, the FBI has been in active the longest, And it is also the country whose drug trafficking is most intimately linked to American consumption. And as we can see from the headlines from day to day, it is a point where the drug forces in Mexico have penetrated government. They are fighting a war now where you don't even know which side the drug forces are on, because most of the significant drug victories against drug kingpins are done with the help of other drug kingpins who want to see them overthrown. So it is a very corrupt society. And they've also, I don't want to sound anti-Mexican, it is a country where some very courageous efforts to deal with this, at great risk and a great loss of life. It's almost 30,000 people now who died in the drug wars in Mexico. This is a state of war. And what I, in my chapter, want to point out, that one of the culprits here is the CIA, who built up a connection with a particular Mexican agency. It's now defunct, but the successor agencies are still there, called the Dirección Federal de Seguridad, the DFS, that the CIA knew it was involved in drug trafficking and had simultaneously preferred to work with it over all other agencies. It's a little metaphor for what has happened all over the world, where the CIA has done the same sort of thing in Thailand, in Lebanon, in Vietnam, with Ngo Dinh Nu, with Ali Walid Karzai, the brother of the president of Afghanistan. But the results have been so disastrous in Mexico, and we've seen that no American agency has done what it should have done. Even they had a great sting in this Operation Casablanca, where they lured a lot of people into a bank to launder the funds and then arrested them. And eventually the whole thing was hushed up at a higher level. This was in Nevada. America was in a position to put these people in jail. No, it was... It's always a question of higher political concerns, and so it's not even properly written about. I'm one of the very few books, I think, that mentions it.
So Banamex was involved in laundering the drug money?
All the banks were, including Banamex. And what helped me there, was it Robert Rubin, who was then the Secretary of the Treasury, who killed the investigation? Then he went back to, I think it was Citibank, and Citibank simply bought Banamex, and then Citibank got involved in its own drug money laundering scandals. But I don't want to pick on one bank. There's another bank, Wachovia, admitted to laundering $485 billion. And they paid a fine of, I'm doing this from memory, I may be wrong, something like $30 or $40 billion. And again, the whole thing is hushed up because Wachovia is defunct, taken over by the bank where I bank, Wells Fargo. But this is a reminder to us that although it's always presented to us in the media as if people, the Taliban is profiting from drug money, everybody's profiting, including big banks in America, which over and over will plead no contest and pay a fine, which is always a tiny percentage of the money that they made. There was a bank in Boston that was dealing directly with the underworld in Boston, laundering their funds. It's not usually as naked as that. More usually, they the ones in New York that create a private bank. And then the brother of the president of Mexico comes with a few hundred million he would like to in deposit, and no questions are asked. They've created the bank to deal with these deposits. President of Nigeria, the same thing, profitable to the banks in Boston. And the head of the UN Office of Drugs and Crime, when we had the huge downturn in 2007, he said, and it wasn't very well reported in this country, that he knew of banks that only survived in that downturn by laundering drug money. Drug money is a significant factor. There are all kinds of estimates, and not all of them are useless, I would say. But the fact is, they're a significant factor in the global economy. That I think the top three on the question of values in trade, the top three commodities on the international markets in whatever order are petroleum, arms, and drugs. And drugs and arms go together because where you have an illicit drug trade, frequently one way that they're paid for is arms going in the other direction, although it melds into all kinds of things, into stolen cars, into trafficking with humans, essentially the sex slave trade, which is very big. All of these things grow out of drugs. That's why it's so important. We should be dealing with drugs, and we're not dealing with drugs. And in fact, the easiest way to deal with drugs could be done right here in this country, which would be to legalize them. And maybe when I say legalize, I really mean decriminalize. You can still, we don't want to see massive drug consumption in this country. You can establish controls on how drugs are consumed, but you have to take the big profits out of it, and that would be the best way to shrink the global drug traffic. And as long as we have people in Washington, as we do now, saying we will never talk about legalization, they are saying we will continue to make it easy for the drug traffickers to reap these huge profits. Marijuana, for example, is a big issue right now. If people could grow their own marijuana, for one thing, they would be consuming a much less potent part of it because Sinsemilla and all these variants of marijuana have been developed so that you can pack more power into less space. That is deemed to meet the needs of drug trafficking, illegal drug trafficking. If California could tax the marijuana industry in California, it could get out of its economic crisis very quickly. I doubt it's going to happen because the financial interests are too big now. It's going to be very, very, but that would be a way to start.
You said in your book that the United States' backdoor covert foreign policy has been the single largest cause of the illicit drugs flooding the entire world. Could you talk about how the poppy growth and opium production in Afghanistan is funding our wars today?
Where I can talk with most confidence is back in time, right after World War II. The world drug trade was severely interrupted by World War II and was, right after the war, insignificant. Since that time, it has built up very, very rapidly, and you can trace where it was built up. If I could just talk about opium and opiates, it built up first in Burma. Afterwards, that was with an army there that was being armed and financed. And it needed to be supplied by air, so we created an airline, a CIA airline that flew arms in, and we had an arrangement with Taiwan and the Kuomintang there that they co-owned the planes, so the planes would fly the drugs out. These were landlocked armies in Burma. The CIA, well, I should say the United States, by its conscious decision to supply that army was responsible for the building up of the drug trade in that area. Before the war, Burma was not a significant factor in the global drug trade, but it went in about a decade from maybe 80 tons to 800 tons, something like that. A huge increase. And as I've said already, this continued to increase. We're getting out of the Golden Triangle by, at the height of the war, something like 1,200 tons. When America pulled out of that area, the drug consumption didn't drug production didn't disappear, but it shrank. And what is very alarming to me that where you have created the demand, production supply will meet demand. And that's when you begin to see a buildup in Afghanistan. And then suddenly, lo and behold, the CIA is conducting covert operations in Afghanistan. Again, I'm condensing history, but there is no doubt that we supplied something like more than $1 billion, certainly, to Mujahideen in Afghanistan. And about half of that went to one single man, Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, who in that period became arguably the largest heroin trafficker in the world. So everywhere where the CIA has been involved, everywhere that drug production has gone, has increased rapidly like this, it is more complicated than what I'm saying, but the general rule is you see that the CIA has been there. I should have mentioned Lebanon and the Bekaa Valley, which is also a source of drugs, both marijuana and now to some extent opium. And the CIA is no longer powerful the way it was, but in the 50s when it built up, the CIA was involved with the people who were building it up. Cocaine in Colombia. Colombia has become the major source of, that is the country where the United States and the CIA have been most involved. And I will say that in 1990, I was at a drug conference just when President Bush announced his Andes project to fight a war. It's going to be a war on drugs. That was the name of it. And I said, if we fight that war in Colombia, I predict that the drug production will go up and the drug importation into this country will go up. And even I, in 1990, had no idea that in 10 years, the drug production would multiply by a factor of, it would be three times what it had been in 1990. So you want to end the import of drugs from Colombia and CIA operations in Colombia. It's very simple. It's not going to happen, but there is, yes, I say, I don't want to sound as if there's only one thing that made all this happen. It is a complicated story, and it's quite a big book where I write about it. But anyone who reads that book, I think, will share my feeling is that terribly wrong decisions were made by Americans, which are a major factor in the problem that we face today.
One of the pictures in your book, you have an American soldier walking through a poppy field in Afghanistan. We know that the amount of opium coming out of Afghanistan has multiplied. Could you speak to that?
In 2000, just before America went into Afghanistan, the Taliban, in response to, they wanted to be recognized because at that time only three countries recognized them. And America said, well, you'll have to get rid of the poppy production. Well, the Taliban used ruthless measures, but they did. They got rid of it in their area. And the only drugs that came out of Afghanistan in that area came up in the northeast from Badakhshan, which was under the control of the Northern Alliance. Well, in 2001, America went into Afghanistan, and surprise, surprise, we went in, our allies were the Northern Alliance, and they had to make a decision in Washington. Well, they're drug traffickers, but they're useful, we'll use them. And America not only allied with drug traffickers on the ground, they even brought a drug trafficker back from France, where he had retired, saying, we are going into Afghanistan, we want you to help us. And then in short order, I don't even want to take the base year, the year that there was no drug production, but before that it was under 4,000 tons, and in 8 years it was 8,000 tons. And it's shrunk since then, but the major reason it's shrunk is that there are now various blights which are affecting the opium crop. It's a monoculture in huge areas of Afghanistan, and that has a result that there are natural consequences. It is still the source of something like 90% of the world's opiates. And this is all, before 1979, when the CIA first went in there, its contribution to the global drug trade was insignificant. And its contribution to American consumption was insignificant. After 1 year of American involvement, by according to the Reagan government statistics, something like 60%. So there are consequences of doing these things. And if we were to go into Yemen in a big way, the same thing would happen again.
Professor Scott, very quickly, what is Force X?
I talked in the Road to 9/11 about a deep state in this country, drawing on the analogy of Turkey, where there's a very clearly established with CIA help, parallel state that with impunity kills people and finances itself from drugs and is allied with the security elements of the government. I decided in this country to go easy on the notion of a deep state. I'm linked to it a lot, but it connotes to people hearing it the idea that there's something in this country that, like there is in Turkey. Well, I don't see that. I do see that the public state at various points, and there's more than one, interfaces with powers outside, with the underworld, but particularly with what I call the overworld, people who are wealthy enough and have enough financial influence to guide policies. And that there has been those forces pushing us in the direction of militarization for decades. And I, in my book, talk about a Force X that is driving us that way. But I'm afraid that my real answer is you have to read my book, because it isn't something for which there's a simple answer. But I think there is a cumulative picture of bad decisions made, particularly in the CIA, to ally themselves with underworld elements and with drug trafficking elements, which has contributed. It turned us in Asia from having a defense establishment into having what was clearly now an offense establishment. And it's the offense establishment that got us into Vietnam, into Iraq, into Afghanistan. And we have to go back to having a defense establishment. But to deal with that, you've got to deal with all the factors I talk about in my book.
The media used for this episode are at the show's web address, www.unwelcomeguests.net/535. Thanks to Drazen for the suggestion about Peter Dale Scott. If you're interested in helping with the show, you're welcome to join the mailing list at altruists.org/unwelcome. There's a category of Unwelcome Guests episodes on the military-industrial complex, and there's a category on deep politics, which you can find in the topic index on our website, and all previous episodes are available for download from our archive, unwelcomeguests.net/archive. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening. Keep giving all you can.